Chapter 8. The Computerized Office, The Revenge of the Body. It is not only in the environment that technology tends to replace life-threatening problems with slower-acting and more persistent problems, nor is it only outdoors that nature fights back. Changes in our business surroundings have been equally surprising, and often as frustrating. On one hand, business is now conducted at a pace and with an accuracy that 19th-century scientists and visionaries from Charles Babbage to Jules Verne did not dare to predict. In fact, microprocessor power has overtaken many of the grandest expectations of 20th-century computer pioneers. On the other hand, the benefits of automated data and word processing have not been quite as expected. The revenge effects are physical. What had promised to make work painless unexpectedly attacks muscles, tendons, and vertebrae. The revenge is also financial. What had promised to make services more efficient has returned astonishingly low net benefits. These matters are, of course, linked. Disability, health, comfort, and stress are reflected in financial statements, too. But they are parallel stories, and each deserves a chapter of its own. I-O, it's off to work we go. Over the last 50 years, Americans have moved in huge numbers from the hot, often dangerous factory floor to the relative comfort of the office. This shift marks not only a movement from production to administrative work, but also a deep change in the style of production. We have already seen the difference some historians of technology recognize between tool use and tool management, between acting with material and acting on it. By substituting microprocessor and software-controlled machines for older mechanical linkages, we have added yet another level between us and the action. Originally, all the controls of an aircraft were directly linked through cables to flaps, ailerons, and rudder. An airline pilot today, commanding the latest in aircraft design, except in a few emergencies, has no mechanical contact with the plane's systems at all. The pilot is no longer even managing tools, but managing the tools that manage other tools. When I first came to work at Princeton University Press in the late 1970s, my most memorable experience was a tour of one of America's last major hot metal typesetting plants, with its small corps of linotype operators. The linotype is a managed tool, but it is still 100 times more directly physical than the laser-driven electronic typesetters that have replaced it. The linotype melts lead, arranges slugs with the reverse impressions of characters in rows, and then casts one full line after another. The force needed to work the keys, the sound of the mechanism, the smell of the lead, all make the experience a form of shop work similar to the hand-setting of type that it replaced over 100 years ago, and in fact, more industrial. Today's keyboarding can be done anywhere, including the Third World, and the space where codes are converted to a typeset image is likely to be quiet and cool. In fact, writing itself has become far less physical since the Victorian invention of the steel-nibbed pen relieved teachers, students, and clerks of the bother and of the skill of sharpening goose and turkey quills. With some reason, contemporaries called the steel pen the knitting needle of civilization. Even where tons of goods must move physically, human agency is at greater and greater removes, based usually in an office rather than a shop. It is possible to manage all the freight in an entire region, in fact in all of North America, from a single giant bunker with no track in sight, as though it were the subterranean redoubt of the Strategic Air Command. Not that centralized control always works with military precision. Crashes of new systems have tied up passenger and freight trains for hours in the western states and near Hamburg, Germany. This manipulation of the world behind protective windows has found its way into popular culture, as Homer Simpson, a cartoon employee in a nuclear power plant, fumbles his way over and over into near catastrophe. Homer is funny partly because tool-managing technology can insulate him from his own incompetence and inattention. Yet his hellish boss, Montgomery Burns, is removed by still another level of windows. The video cameras and the monitor bank in his office that together turn the plant into a vast panopticon. The 20th century office itself shows the same growing distance from production. My father's Depression-era Underwood typewriter, still graceful to use, reveals its bars, shafts, gears, and even its bell for all to see. Margins are set by releasing tiny levers and positioning metal blocks along a rod. With an assortment of replacement springs, screws, and other hardware, and perhaps a lathe and some ingenuity for really difficult repairs, it could last forever and produce works as good as the user's brain, just as untold 19th-century hand presses are still serving hobbyists, artists, and museums. A sequence of typewriters recently exhibited at New York's Cooper Hewitt Museum made it clear how industrial designers and their customers have been increasingly determined over the years to conceal these mechanisms. First, a massive beveled glass plate, worthy of a reliquary, was introduced. Then the whole chassis vanished behind gracefully sculptured metal. Messy ribbons were packaged in cartridges and cassettes, and durable cloth yielded to disposable film. As the new models were finished in almost every color but black, typewriters were already on their way to being black boxes in the technological sense, mechanisms opaque to the user. Meanwhile, developing countries, with educated clerks and skilled mechanics but computer-unfriendly electric service, have been importing massive numbers of cast-off American manual machines. Similarly, the photocopiers and laser printers that have replaced mimeographs not only eliminate the bother of cutting a stencil, but also conceal the application of ink to paper. In fact, ink has nearly vanished as a visible fluid, once available in gallon jugs, and has been reincarnated as powdery toner in sealed housings stenciled with warnings against exposure to sunlight. Even most luxury fountain pens accept ink cartridges, and disposable low-end models are non-refillable. Likewise, audio and videotape, as well as computer diskettes, have retreated into hard plastic shells. The tortoise strategy has indeed won the technological race. Shifting workers to offices and reducing direct physical contact with the mechanisms and materials of office work is part of the same process, an apparent insulation of men and women from the physical dangers and discomforts of earlier stages of industrial society. Margaret and Robert Hazen, science writers and cultural historians, have examined the retreat of combustion from the 19th and 20th century household, from the open hearth to the cast-iron stove, and thence to a basement furnace fueled by materials the householder never expects to see, touch, or smell. Electric power, whether generated by oil, gas, or nuclear fuel, represents the ultimate isolation of heat sources from the consumer. The barriers are imperfect. Even natural gas lines, otherwise the cleanest and safest sources of residential energy, may leak dangerously. But who would deny that we are safer than the Victorians with their open fires and stoves? Just as central heating has improved not only comfort but safety, residential space heaters are still far more dangerous than furnaces, the shift to automated monitoring, administration, and distribution in the modern office once seemed to promise a new age of more healthful and satisfying work. Within the workplace, the prophets of automation foresaw a golden age of human creativity, once electrical and electronic devices had successfully replaced drudgery. IBM's ubiquitous Think signs encapsulated Thomas J. Watson's mantra, quote, "Machines should work, people should think," unquote. Human liberation, not only from gross physical danger, but from stultifying routine, still inspires the prophecies, prospectuses, and profits of hardware and software producers. In the 1950s, American notables helped celebrate the 25th anniversary of Fortune magazine by painting the year 1980 in tones that rivaled the most radiant forecast of the Soviet Politburo. David Sarnoff of RCA predicted, quote, "Small atomic generators installed in homes and industrial plants will provide power for years and ultimately for a lifetime without recharging," unquote. John von Neumann of the Institute for Advanced Study and the Atomic Energy Commission speculated that energy might even, quote, "be free, just like the unmetered air," unquote. Henry R. Luce himself foresaw the global stewardship of consciousness by high organization, as represented by the multinational American corporation, bureaucracies, and labor unions. Making a living would no longer be an issue. Bread had already become a drug on the market. By the 1970s, prophets of the future workplace had learned that the safest bet was to predict unremitting and bewildering change. One could be right no matter what happened, unless, of course, a long period of stability ensued. As the world's romance with atoms for peace came to an end, futurists shifted their sights toward a new utopianism, visions of a knowledge-driven information economy in which altering the position of matter at or near the Earth's surface, in Bertrand Russell's phrase, would become almost a memory. Business magazines once adored the giants of smokestack industry. They have since shifted their admiration to entrepreneurs whose products either are largely intangible, Microsoft, or are produced in myriad overseas plants, Nike. John Naisbitt's Megatrends, 1982, delivered a brief history of the United States in the succession of occupational titles most frequently reported by the U.S. Census over the course of this century: farmer, laborer, clerk. Even in work like farming and trucking, air-conditioned cabs and improved suspension have increased the distance between the operator and the immediate environment. Simultaneously, clericalization and computerization have gone hand in hand. According to one estimate, 3/4 of all U.S. jobs will involve full or part-time computer operation by the end of the century. Already, the paperwork-laden police ride with laptop computers mounted in the front seats of their squad cars as though they were partners. In the new workplace, everything seems to be under far more control. The air is warmer or cooler depending on the season. The lights are brighter. The incidence of traumatic accidents is far lower. Tragedies still happen in manufacturing and food processing. For example, the fire at the poultry processing plant operated by Imperial Food Products in Hamlet, North Carolina, which claimed 25 lives in September 1991. But this was far from the record toll of 145 in the fire 80 years earlier at New York's Triangle Shirtwaist Company. And while Triangle's owners were never charged, the owner of the North Carolina plant accepted a 20-year prison sentence for involuntary manslaughter. Between the 1930s and the 1990s, worker death rates fell 75%. In California, there were only 18 deaths per 100 million hours worked in 1985, down from 127 in 1939. None of this implies that workers are now adequately protected from potential trauma. This still depends not only on worker practices, but on the technologies, conditions, and policies set by their employers. Injuries rose sharply in some industries in the 1970s and 1980s, sometimes wiping out decades of gains. But steadily, the problem becomes less technical and more social. We know more and more about making work safe. The obstacle is not the availability of technology. It is having the money and will to deploy it. The question is whether some combination of employer self-interest, collective bargaining, and legislation can require using what is already there. Rewards or pressure from supervisors sometimes lead workers to evade safeguards, increasing risk of injury. And, of course, there is an ethical question of how much risk a rational worker should be allowed to take voluntarily for a higher income, a question familiar to anyone who has seen the denouement of The Magnificent Ambersons. The reduction of fatal accidents does not mean an end to the health hazards of working. As the old catastrophes have receded, complications of chronic exposure to substances new and old have come to the fore. A report of the National Safe Workplace Institute in 1990 concluded that up to 10% of cancer deaths in 1987 and up to 5% of deaths from a variety of neurological diseases were work-related. But these are not what has driven up the cost of workers' compensation insurance. It is another kind of physical problem, one that results not from viruses, microbes, or toxins, but from activities that in themselves appear harmless. Sitting, typing at a keyboard, handling files and papers, looking at text or other data on a screen. Some of our concerns arise because we are in an office or home office. Worries that don't trouble us when we are not using technology identified as business equipment. Consider electromagnetic fields, EMFs. Some physicists insist they have to be harmless because we already absorb so much electromagnetic radiation from the Earth itself and even from our own bodies. Swedish and Finnish authorities in the early 1990s became convinced, on the other hand, that EMFs from video monitors could promote miscarriages and leukemia. Even the noted pro-technology futurist Paul Sappho exclaimed in a 1993 column in Byte that the information revolution should carry a health warning, not because the case against EMFs had been proved, but because manufacturers and the U.S. government were still refusing to deal with the evidence that already existed. Sappho's alarm is understandable, especially since there is no evidence of benefits that might balance possible risks of EMFs. I bought a low-radiation monitor and mounted a radiation-absorbing filter on it. I also wondered about my bedside electric alarm clock, which I learned probably emits more EMFs than the monitor. I moved it a few feet away. The most famous problems, but not the most common or necessarily the most serious, are the cumulative trauma disorders, CTDs. Whereas traumatic injury arises from a single massive impact, the repetitive disorder is thought to arise from hundreds or thousands of small motions, or even from a position that seems to require little motion at all. But trauma is a spectacular event. Repetitive injuries may appear suddenly and painfully, but they develop slowly and imperceptibly. A lay observer can identify the victim of trauma from blood, bruises, or the bandages and crutches that follow treatment. A physician can map traumatic damage through X-rays and electronic scans. But neither can always pick out a man or woman with a cumulative trauma disorder. The white-collar workplace has its own potential catastrophes, from tipping file cabinets to robbers and deranged co-workers, and may harbor known and suspected microbes and toxins from Legionnaire's disease bacteria to the carpet chemicals we have already encountered. But much more likely are back and upper limb problems. Once they appear, symptoms may persist for years. They are painful, sometimes disabling, but usually not visible on the employee's body. Consequently, the typical sufferer from them may need to fight for recognition of a chronic condition that is all too real. In fact, physicians and scientists still have no way to measure pain directly and unambiguously, either as nerve impulses or brain waves. Some have drawn up scales and proposed units of pain. Others have tried to infer levels of pain from other evidence. But as yet, there is still no reliable technique to establish the existence of suffering. Insurance company lawyers may call automobile whiplash injury a license to steal because no objective imaging procedure or test can diagnose it, but a strained muscle or sprained ligament in the neck is an extremely painful condition that can arise from even a minor collision. As often happens, such injuries may easily be faked, and perhaps there is a borderline region in which honest people, knowing that even minor symptoms are grounds for compensation, subconsciously focus on their pain, amplifying it. Yet the most recent research on whiplash injury suggests that there is no relationship between neuroticism and time needed for recovery. Office hazards share important characteristics with whiplash. Potentially catastrophic consequences from relatively small impacts, psychological complications with charges of malingering and neurosis, skepticism of many physicians and insurers. Nothing illustrates the tendency of contemporary technology better than the prevalence of back pain, one of the most economically serious illnesses of the industrial world. It affects 31 million Americans and is estimated to cost $16 billion annually in medical care and disability payments. Physicians may explain sciatica, the often intense referred pain in the legs, by pointing to a herniated disc on an X-ray or a CAT scan. But 20-30% of all patients examined for other conditions also turn out to have disc bulges, yet feel no back pain at all. Some doctors claim that computerized motion analysis can distinguish organic from psychogenic pain or pure malingering, but the tests are costly and have not been rigorously validated. Nor do they serve to distinguish psychological illness from conscious cheating. What tests can reveal is that, when asked to apply increasing force until pain compels a stop, a patient does not exert a consistent maximum force. Over time, the same tests can also document the effectiveness of physical therapy. But the body is a black box for these techniques. Degenerated discs, sprained ligaments, the sacroiliac joint, facet joints, lumbar instability, all plausible causes of pain, have vocal medical defenders and there are too few controlled studies to make clear the origins of pain. Most of us would link back problems to heavy lifting, and might expect that as men and women moved from farm and shop labor to the repose of the office chair, the nation's backs would have straightened up. Watching modern rail construction equipment put down long stretches of welded track as though it were slowly closing a giant zipper, today's train passengers may rarely see the kind of back-breaking labor that built the original roadbed, made the cuttings, and dug the tunnels. But there are still far too many back injuries in manufacturing, transportation, and distribution, even though in general we understand industrial back injury and have the technology needed to reduce it, but don't always use it. In addition to elevators, conveyors, and carousels, there is an impressive series of devices that can reduce stress on the lower back, even if some introduce new risks to the back from vibration, as do forklift trucks. Where lifting is necessary, industrial safety specialists have devised posters, charts, and well-established courses for employees. To many users, support belts appear to reduce back injuries significantly in warehouse work, nursing, and other occupations with high-risk lifting, though some studies have questioned their benefits. Back care specialists have learned more about lifting in recent years, especially the dangers of twisting motions. Performed correctly, some heavy labor is actually safer than one might expect, a reverse revenge effect. Dr. Christopher Michelson, director of the Orthopedic Spine Service at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, has observed that longshoremen have a below-average rate of back injury, possibly because their work keeps them in better shape and aerobically fit. Office workers turn out to be at surprisingly high risk for back pain, even if they lift nothing weightier than the odd ream of paper. There are 40 times more back pain cases among office workers than cumulative trauma disorders. The Western style of sitting may be less healthy than the floor-level living that prevails or once prevailed in Asia and the Middle East. Most chairs ought to carry warning labels. The original Chinese word for chair means barbarian bed. Sitting in one, as opposed to standing or walking, puts dangerous stresses on the spine. In fact, office workers have as high a rate of back injury as truckers. Perhaps this is why, even in the West, some tailors worked squatting until relatively recently. What makes the chair-bound life so hazardous, like the origin of other chronic conditions, is elusive. Part of the answer is negative. A person who sits all day and gets no other regular exercise is more likely to suffer back muscle disorders when at last doing something strenuous. The weekend warrior syndrome. Yet some back pain patients are otherwise fit. Sedentary work can exhaust hardy men and women. Jack London's John Barleycorn recalls unforgettably how the office technology of the early 20th century appeared to a laborer struggling to write in the evenings on his brother-in-law's typewriter. Quote, "How my back used to ache with it. Prior to that experience, my back had been good for every violent strain put upon it in a none-too-gentle career. But that typewriter proved to me that I had a pipe stem for a back," unquote. London's experience, we should recall, had included seafaring, jute mill labor, and time at a municipal railroad job shoveling two men's previous quotas of coal. London would have been unimpressed by the claim of an early advocate of the typewriter that the machine, quote, "banishes cramp in the hand," unquote. High-backed, heavily upholstered executive chairs, long on status but short on support for the lower back, still pass in some circles as badges of corporate eminence. But even scientifically designed seating can confuse hierarchy and function. The designer of one of the earliest and most commercially successful ergonomic models once confided to me that the high back of top-of-the-line models is a secular variant of the nimbus of medieval religious art, a halo to frame the sitter's head, even though many chairs with head supports do not even allow enough backward leaning to make use of them. At the other social extreme are secretarial and task chairs offering little more than a seat and a contoured backrest. Until the 1980s, psychologists studying workstations pictured the ideal body position as a stack of rectangular blocks with their surfaces parallel to or perpendicular to the floor and work surface. A head-slash-trunk cube, a thigh cube, and a lower leg cube. Many office chairs still reflect this outmoded, Cubist model with its rigid 90-degree posture. A series of independent studies by groups led by E. Grandjean and by A. C. Mandal gave office chair design new dimensions. Truly upright sitting, while it may look healthy and alert, has the revenge effect of rotating the pelvis backward, straightening the lordosis, or curvature, that is part of the spine's natural shape in the standing position. Leaning backward 15 degrees, Grandjean, or tilting the seat pan and the backrest slightly forward to approximate the position of a horseback rider, Mandal, were both ways to cut stress on the spinal discs and muscles. The ergonomic psychologist Marvin J. Danoff and his collaborators have argued that the choice of positions depends on the work at hand. Reclining is better for reading text from a terminal with its large characters, while leaning forward is more appropriate for paper copy and other work involving fine detail. Grandjean's and Mandal's research appeared just as architects and manufacturers were beginning independently to produce furniture that not only looked stylish, but responded to the user's motions and postures. The Bauhaus movement of the 1920s and 1930s, for all its homage to science and to functionality, appears never to have sponsored such expert studies of seating. Some of its aesthetic high points, like Marcel Breuer's tubular steel and fabric strap, Vasili chair, are among those objects that are better for the mind to admire than for the body to use. Ludwig Mies van der Rohe probably spoke for many another international school architect when he described a chair as more difficult to construct than a skyscraper. Other modernist designs, especially those from Northern Europe, are more stylish versions of old-fashioned desk chairs shaped more accurately to the human back. Others, like the vertebra chair co-designed by the architect Emilio Ambaz in 1987, renounce the idea of a single correct position in favor of maximum freedom to change position, whether by inclining, reclining, flexing the back, or just shifting around. No doubt under the influence of Grandjean and Mandal, aggressive lumbar support yielded to a new laid-back philosophy. In the 1980s and early 1990s, the movement for safer office conditions collided with a drive to downscale the workforce, to reduce the number of employees and the money spent on them. Ergonomic seating may reduce expenses in the long run, but it is also costly. Unit prices of $500, $600, and even $1,000 or more are common compared with the $150 to $250 range of mass-produced office furniture. But price is only the beginning. The real challenge in using ergonomic chairs to reduce back injury is that they require time to learn to use properly. Most employees never learn to make the adjustments needed to take advantage of the costly features. It takes little time or effort to do so, but the use of such chairs does have to be learned. Training videos are one way to impress their features on new users. So far, a handful of self-adjusting ergonomic chairs have lost in the marketplace. Kneeling chairs like the Balans, the earth shoes of seating, delight some users and cut off the circulation of others. Even comfort apparently requires study and vigilance. The most talked-about office chair of the mid-1990s, the membrane-covered Uron by Bill Stumpf and Don Chadwick of Herman Miller, is said to mimic the body's natural motions and may become the long-awaited exception. It is one of the few chairs designed for body sizes, not corporate rank, but petite or king size, and it is not cheap. Even the finest of chairs suffers from another revenge effect of office technology on the back, the fact that more work is done without leaving the workstation. The networked office of the 1990s has reduced the need for trips to supply rooms, filing cabinets, printout racks, printers, fax machines, and other computers. Sneakernet. Just as word processing eliminates the breaks that conventional typing requires, networked communications, especially document imaging, eliminates the walking from working. Each single instance of time or task saving may improve productivity in itself, yet taken together they can promote dangerous semi-immobility. And the division of labor among industrial psychologists is such that communication researchers study ways to reduce walking to face-to-face meetings, while ergonomists work to offset the health problems of reduced motion. It is even hard to say how much back pain a chair can cause or prevent. There is reason to believe that frustration has more to do with back pain than the mechanical effects of seating. Even if research showed a lower rate of back pain in companies with top-of-the-line ergonomic seating, it might not be easy to tell whether the credit should go to the chairs or to the enlightened management style that resulted in their purchase. Since consultants generally can't tell bosses to stop making people feel helpless and abused, the chair is the stand-in for the company. When thinking of the physical side of the computerized office, we might as well start with the window the computer presents, the video display terminal, VDT, or simply the monitor. Terminal and monitor both hark back to an earlier day of interactive computing, when instructions and results appeared on a teletyper roll, traces of which survive in such computer commands as echo, repeat an instruction, and type, display the contents of a file, no longer necessarily in print. Now we relate to our monitors differently, not only visually but qualitatively. Interaction is no longer periodic. Central processing units, CPUs, usually execute commands within mere seconds, if not milliseconds, whether they are part of a mainframe computer, a network server, a desktop machine, or a portable laptop or notebook unit. It is the CPU that wastes millions of cycles waiting for us. In the popular culture of computing, and especially where computers are being sold, the monitor is a window. It is not just an aperture that makes the machine operations visible. It is also a stage light that plays over the user's face. For computer marketers and for computer enthusiasts in education, the glow of the screen is literally visible enlightenment, the user soaking up the rays of information. Monitors are clearer and less expensive than ever, but they have dropped more slowly in price than most other computer components. Theoretically, they don't have to be big or expensive, being little more than television sets outfitted with fancy electronics that let them receive more kinds of signals and produce tighter images. But only the costliest video cards can approximate the number of colors, and thus the degree of realism, we observe on an ordinary TV set. The large monitors that people really need in order to work simultaneously with several applications are still so costly that only 5% of all monitors sold in the early 1990s exceeded 15 inches. The largest sizes, 20 inches and above, still cost more than $2,000, sometimes more than $3,000, because so many cathode ray tubes are imperfect and must be discarded in manufacturing. They may weigh 60 to 80 pounds and may qualify as a space heater. High-quality flat active matrix color screens are beautiful and legible, but they too have daunting reject rates in manufacturing, which result in corresponding shortages. While prices are declining slowly in the mid-1990s and 10.4-inch color displays are becoming standard, the big, flat, moderately priced display once announced so confidently by industry futurists still seems years away. The computer monitor is little more than an awkward compromise, usually too small to display a full page, let alone allow work on two or more documents at once, as software vendors encourage users to do. The headers, menus, and multiple button bars of graphic interface applications require some of the space, though it is usually possible to remove them. The optimal speed for repainting the screen is 100 times per second. Faster refresh rates can actually make text harder to read, yet most monitors in use still don't support even the industry standard of 70 to 72 hertz cycles per second. An ordinary book or magazine is typeset at 1200 dots per inch, DPI. A computer display is only a tenth as sharp in a single dimension, which means only a hundredth in two dimensions. Earlier, office work required the physical strain of hard manual operations. Now, electronic offices, as well as schools and libraries, have added a new kind of visual stress. As the geographer Jean Gottman put it, we have moved from hot sweat to cold sweat. In the mid-1990s, we still know very little about the health effects of electrical and magnetic fields in general. The U.S. National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, has consistently failed to identify significant risks. Even heavy computer users may get more exposure from electric shavers and clocks and microwaves than from their video display. One study found that ambient AM radio signals induce stronger currents in the human body than a terminal does. The greatest exposure is at the back and sides, not when seated in the normal operator's position. In any case, electromagnetic radiation from displays is relatively cheap to reduce. Most premium monitors already meet Swedish government anti-radiation standards, among the highest in the industry. Effective anti-radiation screens generally don't cost more than $100 to $150, a small amount relative to the cost of an entire computer workstation. Eye strain is common among computer users. One survey of optometrists suggested that 10 million Americans seek professional help for computer-related eye strain and related problems each year. It also reveals that symptoms related to video terminals prompt 14% of all eye examinations. Excessive use can produce myopia, requiring prescription lenses, although computers usually merely accelerate an existing problem or tendency. In fact, no study appears to have compared systematically the effects of equally intensive work with paper documents. Of course, it is easier to control the lighting of a conventional desktop than to adjust windows, overhead lighting, monitor positions, and filters to avoid glare. This part of the eye strain problem is new, but it is growing not so much because of computer technology, but because more people are working in offices. For most users, working with a monitor simply means following routines and practicing exercises, each of which is simple in itself, but which together demand much more attention than old-style paperwork ever did. There is not only the proper positioning of the monitor with respect to windows, which should be at right angles, but the adjustment of the monitor's height for the best angle of vision, the adjustment of brightness, contrast, and colors for different applications, and the need to take regular breaks from work. The best way to reduce eye strain, in fact, is simply to focus from time to time on a distant object. All these are simple precautions, but they still require attentiveness that was unnecessary in the classic paperwork age of file cards and vertical files that began in the late 19th century and ended in the late 20th. If the risks of using monitors are relatively easy to minimize, keyboard disorders are still under a diagnostic cloud. A report published by Herman Miller Research and Design notes that the United Kingdom, Australia, and other Commonwealth countries prefer to call them repetitive strain injuries, Scandinavia and Japan, occupational cervicobrachial disorders, and the World Health Organization, work-related disorders. There are a dozen or more muscle, tendon, or nerve problems included in the cumulative trauma disorder, CTD, category. Carpal tunnel syndrome, CTS, and tendonitis are only the best known of the CTDs. Carpal tunnel syndrome, like other computer-related health problems, is hard to document. Similar to automobile whiplash injury, CTS appears both real and difficult to verify. Once more, the ability of medical imaging to isolate and map the site of a condition turns out to have unexpected limits. In 1993, an English judge rejected the diagnosis as a basis for compensation, infuriating CTS sufferers in the United States as well by calling the diagnosis of repetitive strain injury a, quote, meaningless one with no pathology and no place in the medical books, unquote. In the United States, too, some analysts insist that fitness, personal habits, and stress at home and work have a much greater role than technology itself. The Wall Street Journal lists the following proposed explanations, among others: diabetes, weight, menopause, hysterectomy, wrist size, relationship with supervisors, job pace, posture, length of workday, exercise routine, decision-making authority, job security, and contraceptive use as well as pregnancy. But while every popular diagnosis may magnify pain by focusing attention on it, the underlying disorder is too real to be dismissed as malingering or somatizing. The anatomy behind CTS is well known. As I enter this chapter on my computer, the 9 flexor tendons that control the movement of the fingers of each hand are bunched in an opening surrounded by the 8 carpal bones of my wrist, which are connected by a strong ligament. Through this tube, called the carpal tunnel, the median nerve also connects with the hand's sensory cells. This marvelously compact design is sensitive. A disease or injury that compresses the nerve can produce pain and limit the functions the hand can perform. Medical researchers have found that repeated flexing and extension of the wrist can expand fluid-filled protective sheaths that surround the tendons. But this protective reaction creates its own revenge effect by putting pressure on the median nerve in the carpal tunnel, causing pain and numbness. What makes a CTD such a painful and chronic condition is the thickening of the tendon sheath after repeated acute inflammation, which maintains constant pressure. Once more, the long-term effects of many small insults to the body can be more severe than the consequences of treatable major injuries. The human being did not evolve to perform small, rapid, repeated motions for hours on end. Upper limb disorders appear to have been rare in traditional societies where workers made their own tools. In fact, John Napier, a physician specializing in hand mechanics and evolution, pointed out that the modern look in hand tools often made them less rather than more suited to human needs. Early people in the throes of constructing hand axes never made that mistake. Their lives and livelihood depended on it. And as we have already seen, the peasant societies of Eastern and Central Europe used made-to-measure implements that showed an intuitive sense of the unity of tool and body. But we should not assume that cumulative trauma was entirely absent from pre-industrial technologies. Luther Sowers, a self-taught North Carolina master armorer renowned for the accuracy of his historical reconstructions, wondered in a newspaper interview whether his medieval predecessors shared his tendon pain from working steel and his hand cramps from assembling chainmail. He expected that, quote, if they became apprentices at 12, they'd be cripples by middle age, unquote. The first medical reports of upper limb pain appeared in the early 18th century. If by then it was already a well-established problem, it doubtless reflected rationalization of craft processes. Adam Smith's praise of the division of labor in The Wealth of Nations, 1776, owed much to his belief that the changing activities of country workmen promoted, quote, the habit of sauntering and of indolent, careless application, unquote. Alternating tasks and tools may nevertheless have been healthy. On the other hand, the minute subdivision of activities Smith observed, as many as 80 persons were involved in making a button, may have been pushing workers to a dangerous pace. Quote, the rapidity with which some of the operations in trades like button and pin manufacture are performed exceeds what the human hand could, by those who had never seen them, be supposed capable of acquiring, unquote. The 19th century division of labor and the intensification of small but fast repeated tasks created such ailments as weaver's hand, sprout picker's thumb, stitcher's wrist, and cotton twister's hand. By 1840, the French physician D.M.P. Velpeau had devoted a whole monograph to upper limb disorders. Were 19th century information workers exempt from cumulative trauma disorders? The 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1910, recognized writer's cramp and scrivener's palsy as marked by a spasm that appeared during and only during the act of writing, musical performances, or other learned activity. But, failing to recognize any source of these maladies in actual work conditions, the article described them as, quote, an affection of the central nervous system, unquote, occasionally hereditary, but more often resulting from, quote, a history of alcoholism in the parents, or some neuropathic heredity, unquote. Because of the differences between writing with a pen and using a computer keyboard, it is difficult to say whether writer's cramp and computer-related carpal tunnel syndrome are closely related, nor is it clear whether or not the operator's cramp or glass arm of telegraphers was any closer. What the 20th century contributed was not the symptoms, but the unifying diagnosis. Of course, imaging technology and clinical investigation played a part, but CTD is as much a social as a physiological condition. CTDs among blue-collar workers may have been underreported for decades. Evidence from the back injuries of forklift truck operators suggests that a high rate of injury among young workers may conceal the true scope of the problem by natural selection. Workers with excessive pain may simply switch jobs without filing workers' compensation claims. Similarly, some mature blue-collar workers may be CTD-resistant survivors. Even with the survivor effect, cumulative trauma disorders are still undoubtedly more serious in blue-collar work. They have become alarmingly common. In 1993, over 300,000 new cases were reported, a more than tenfold increase since 1982. They now constitute more than 60% of all workplace injuries, but they are not evenly distributed across industries. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that in 1992 there were nearly 1,400 CTD cases per 10,000 workers in meatpacking and 860 in auto manufacturing, but only 44 in newspaper publishing. The difference is that white-collar computer users are not limited to data entry clerks putting in up to 80,000 keystrokes a day. Elite journalists and financial professionals now are at risk for proletarian aches and pains. Even the rising generation of computer-socialized senior managers has not been immune. Some spreadsheets just can't be delegated. Add the growing number of men and women at all levels who spend most of their time at keyboards and possibly using other entry devices from mice to checkout scanners, and the ingredients of an epidemic are all present. Carpal tunnel syndrome appears to be a repeating revenge effect. The revenge is that computers have reduced even the physical exertion of typing, of striking keys, raising blocks of metal for every capital letter, throwing back the carriage for each new line. If anything had the potential to injure hands and wrists, it would seem to be a manual typewriter. It had a non-detachable keyboard, and wrist rests were almost unknown. Yet there is remarkable little printed evidence of CTS among typists. The pain that Jack London felt on first using the typewriter was in his back, not in his wrists. Some older women typists recall pain that strongly suggests the presence of carpal tunnel syndrome, but contemporary reports of the problem are hard to find. It may be that earlier office workers saw no point in reporting their problems to employers. It takes a certain social and legal framework to define a pain as a symptom. Only recently, perhaps, have safety legislation, medical and disability insurance, and workers' compensation made it possible to file such claims, which in turn appear more often. It is also likely, though, that old-fashioned typing was safer just because it was harder and slower. Some specialists believe that the need for extra pressure distributed more force to shoulders and arms. Manual keys literally had a spring to them that prevented the sharp impacts that firm strokes on a computer keyboard can bring. Try this comparison with your computer and an old manual machine. The mechanics of manual keys also encouraged straight wrists, making less likely the arched and suspended hand positions that seemed to be risk factors for CTS. The need to keep keys from jamming may have helped maintain a slower work rhythm, though ergonomists now consider uninterrupted entry a far more serious work factor than rapid entry alone. Electric typewriters may similarly avoid many of the problems of computer entry. Most of them limit the number of keystrokes per second, and they enforce the same brief healthful interruptions as did manual models. Electric machines have eliminated the hand carriage return, but inserting and removing paper, and even old-style erasures and whiteouts, remain short but probably healthy breaks in routine typing. Even a study of office mechanization and automation published by the International Labor Organization in 1960, calling attention to complaints of muscular fatigues, backache, and other such ills in modern offices, did not identify hand and wrist pain as a specific problem. The report emphasized instead the psychological stress of close attention to monotonous processes. We have already seen that CTDs are far from restricted to the office, although they are thought to affect up to 10% of office workers. They happen wherever automation and the division of labor have led workers to perform manual tasks thousands of times a day, whether sorting letters, making air filters, or binding books. They can also arise from child care, hobbies, home repair, and sports. There appears to be a background rate, unaffected by activities, of about one reported case per 1,000 people per year. All in all, according to U.S. government sources, Upper limb disorders, including but not limited to CTS, now represent half or more of occupational illnesses. Carpal tunnel syndrome alone is said to have a lifetime incidence of 5 to 10% in the United States. Unanswered is the question of why rates of CTDs are so different in organizations with similar work. Worker age, weight, posture, lifestyle, hormone levels, arthritis, herniated discs, all have been linked to CTDs. It is also becoming clear that workers under greater stress, whether clerical or professional, are more likely to develop them. One NIOSH study of telephone operators suggests that even with the best-designed equipment, excessive demands on employees and job insecurity appear to promote carpal tunnel syndrome and other computer-related injuries. In another case, workers who had participated in exercises to reduce CTDs had the same rate of injury a year later. But nobody really knows why some newspapers have significantly higher rates of carpal tunnel syndrome than others with similar equipment. It is also not clear whether new ergonomic equipment deserves most of the credit for reduced cumulative trauma disorder rates, or whether most of the benefit has come from more enlightened work rules and policies. It seems to be one of the rules of revenge effects that just as their causes are multiple and uncertain, their cures can be equally hard to understand. Whatever the ultimate factors behind CTDs, some simple mechanical and behavioral changes can reduce them. Some keyboards permit lighter touch settings that are thought to be healthier, but a too sensitive keyboard can be dangerous if it encourages users to suspend their fingers above the keys rather than maintain constant but light contact. Wrist pads can help people restrict a tendency to bend the wrist upward or downward in typing, but they can also lead users to slide their hands over to hit side keys rather than to lift the arms and hands. Larger ergonomic keyboards may permit more comfortable positioning of hands while typing, but they can also increase the distance from keyboard to pointing device, and this movement of the arm has health consequences of its own. Even the simplest device can turn out to have complex and unexpected results as part of a human routine. As computers have relied more and more on graphic displays, designers and users have shifted attention from the cursor and entry keys to pointing devices that employ sequential arm motions to navigate a cursor on the screen. Instead of remembering or looking up strings of commands to enter, users can pull down menus and change settings in dialog boxes to highlight and perform operations on text and graphics. Most of these input devices are hand-moved mice. Manufacturers have also offered trackballs, pens, and various sized levers from eraser-shaped knobs in the middle of the keyboard to full-size joysticks and generally mediocre adaptations for use with portable computers. Nearly all these pointing devices, designed to make navigation easier, have the revenge effect of requiring removing one hand from the keyboard for each operation of the mouse and then making the user return to the keyboard. A miniature knob located in the keyboard can interfere with normal typing, which can be confusing enough. Apple chose to put tactile marks on its D and K keys, while IBM computers and compatibles have positioning ridges on their F and J keys. Of course, there could be an unexpected benefit from all this shifting. Like the carriage returns of old, it could break up and slow down routines that otherwise might be dangerously fast. But the mouse does add a problem. Ergonomists warn against operating it from the wrist rather than from the forearm. Mice have escaped most of the early controversy about carpal tunnel syndrome, probably because major cases have arisen among workers entering and processing data in text-oriented systems where mice were uncommon. But in 1991, a California medical journal was reporting a new syndrome, mouse joint, observed in a married couple, both of whom used mice at work and at home. The male patient recovered in a month of conservative treatment with splints, rest, and ibuprofen, but the condition returned when he resumed working with the mouse. He apparently preferred to work in pain than to shift to other computer equipment. Possibly there was no keyboard-controlled alternative to the software he was using. Until recently, many Macintosh programs, unlike Microsoft Windows programs, offered no keystroke equivalents to the commands in their pull-down menus. 10 years after the first release of the Apple Macintosh and the rise of mouse-oriented software, there is still no public agreed-upon standard for mouse safety. If there are important proprietary studies, they are well-kept secrets, and corporate safety research has the potential revenge effect of risking heavier damages from later lawsuits as plaintiffs search for evidence that a manufacturer was aware of risks. Thus, when Microsoft introduced a new model of mouse in 1993, its comfort level was more certain than its health implications. Higher and longer, it was raised in the center to fit in the hollow of the user's palm and curved to fit the right thumb. The left and right switches clicked more precisely and sloped away from the center. Microsoft reportedly spent millions to develop the new mouse, and a long file on proper mouse use was included as part of the software. The product is the most comfortable device I have tried, but there is no published claim that its design is any safer to use than the original chiclet-shaped Microsoft mouse or competing models from Logitech, Mouse Systems, and other companies. In fact, while the mouse sits comfortably under the cupped hand, it does not follow that it is actually safer to use than other designs. While nearly all new personal computers are equipped with mice, and many applications do not fully support function keys and other keyboard alternatives, research on pointing devices and health is only beginning. As of 1994, the major manufacturers of mice, as well as of keyboards and other input devices, were still avoiding specific health claims for their products. And wisely so. One of the most frequent, rearranging, revenge effects is that a sense of safety in one part of a system leads to problems in another. For example, a mouse more comfortable to grip could possibly affect the rate of carpal tunnel syndrome by encouraging more intensive use. A trackball, really an upside-down mouse that controls the cursor as the user manipulates a small sphere in a stationary socket, may solve some wrist problems while encouraging overuse of the thumb. A touchpad, a square of material that responds to the light pressure of the edge of one's thumb, may do the same. And for both keyboards and pointing devices, the patterns of use required or encouraged by software may affect the rate of injury as much as hardware design does. On closer examination, what seems to be science and technology turns out to be equally aesthetics, comfort, and a good dose of guesswork. Technological optimists, always ready to dismiss revenge effects as transitional, have seen in voice-activated computing the remedy for the hazards of mouse and keyboard. Since many people already spend much of their day on the telephone with no ill effect, what can be the harm in an occasionally muttered open, save, or exit, except perhaps the stares of one's co-workers at first? In fact, now that voice response systems are commercially available, reports of voice strain are growing. Some of its sufferers are programmers, who adopted voice input after losing full use of their hands to carpal tunnel syndrome. Like other overuse injuries, voice strain may arise from habits that can be avoided. Some users court injury by shouting their commands, but tense muscles can be hazardous even at low volumes. And like carpal tunnel syndrome, voice strain may be promoted by factors like posture and allergies. Users are now seeing speech pathologists who coach them on how to speak, relax, sit, breathe, and take frequent sips of water. It is paradoxical but not unusual that some of the most advanced and apparently effortless technology should require vigilance, practice, and sometimes professional advice in performing the simplest actions. One programmer with voice strain observes how under work pressure, quote, all of a sudden you find your voice has tensed up, unquote. In the late 20th century, staying relaxed may demand ceaseless effort. From easily reversible eye strain to crippling back, hand, and wrist pain, the physical problems of computing have important things in common. They are incremental. They develop slowly, often without a noticeable onset. There can be a sudden crisis of disabling pain, the result of conditions that have persisted for weeks or months. These are only indirectly measurable. X-rays and other imaging can show anomalies consistent with pain, but men and women with similar physical images may not have similar feelings. Above all, these conditions are shaped socially. Political conservatives usually insist on the existence of an objective reality and deny that scientific and even technological knowledge is socially constructed. But partly because there is no dolorometer, no recognized test for pain, only at best devices that may reveal suspiciously inconsistent responses, conservatives, and especially neoconservatives, deplore the economic cost of computer-related claims and see neurosis at work, if not fraud. Liberals, who otherwise perceive the self-interest of medical providers in new syndromes and diagnoses, consider computer-related illness to be objectively real. Both sides would agree that injury rates tend to be higher where work is more stressful. Organizations using similar hardware and software have had such different experience with injuries that social processes must be responsible for part of the difference. But nobody understands yet what the processes may be and how they operate. In the outbreak of reported cumulative trauma disorders in Australia in the 1980s, the largest, most costly, and most prolonged industrial epidemic in world history, according to one medical critic there, there was agreement that medical attitudes were part of the problem and actually helped make it worse. But who was creating the unintended consequences? Was it the office workers who were reporting it, or their labor and feminist allies who helped to promote oversensitivity to minor symptoms and even encourage outright malingering? Australian trade unions are among the world's most socially and politically active, and workers' compensation laws reflect labor's political influence. Or were sympathetic physicians helping the powerless and dependent and those who cannot otherwise express their righteous rage at their supervisors, employers, and spouses to use their exquisitely symbolic pain and incapacity to communicate distress, as one Australian doctor has suggested? Or were skeptical physicians helping to create chronic symptoms by refusing to take early reports seriously and putting the burden of proof on patients, as other analysts have argued? Either way, the epidemic was in part an unintentional consequence of medicalizing what the Australians called, following Commonwealth practice, repetitive strain injury. Not paying attention leads to injuries, but focusing on the physical problems of computing or anything else might have amplified the symptoms. Are sufferers hard workers who have driven themselves too far, coming forward reluctantly only when the pain is unbearable? Or are they consciously or unconsciously trying to escape from responsibility by medicalizing their problems? Questions that begin with seat pans and backrests, forward and backward tilts, micro-switch clicks and wrist supports, turn out to have answers that are psychological, organizational, and even political. The question is whether the ethical burden is on employers to control stress, even at the expense of profits and competitiveness, or on workers, whether data tabulators or editorial writers, to stiffen their upper lips as well as their lower backs. In the last 30 years, the office may have grown more quiet, but it has also become more tense and lonely. Shoshana Zuboff, a social psychologist, has explored the unintended consequences of the automation of office work. Electronic mail has replaced not only face-to-face conferences, but even telephone conversations. One clerk standing and asking a question at another station, more often than not, signals a problem to supervisors. Software-driven application of rules has supplanted decision-making based on personal experience. Sequences of screen prompts leave little room for judgment. The implications of all of this for the body are apparent. Zuboff's fieldwork among clerks suggests that reports of physical problems owe less to equipment design than to social constraint. Automation meant that jobs which had once allowed them to use their bodily presence in the service of interpersonal exchange and collaboration now required their bodily presence in the service of routine interaction with a machine. Jobs that had once required their voices now insisted they be mute. They had been disinherited from the management process and driven into the confines of their individual body space. As a result, the employees in each office became increasingly engulfed in the immediate sensations of physical discomfort. One of Zuboff's subjects looked back nostalgically to the arrays of clerks she remembered from an earlier era as she described her new situation with graphic metaphor. "No talking, no looking, no walking. I have a cork in my mouth, blinders for my eyes, chains on my arms. With the radiation, I have lost my hair. The only way you can make your production goals is to give up your freedom." Published just as cumulative trauma disorders were becoming a major issue in North America, Zuboff's study challenges the vulgar Platonism of computer studies that assumes a frictionless and disembodied world of information processing. Bodies were never noticed much in computing until they started to take revenge in the form of lost time, lawsuits, and workers' compensation claims. There is an important positive consequence of the new agonies of computerized offices. Without the complaints and the potential litigation that eye, upper extremity, and back problems have brought, the health and comfort of all computer users would receive much less attention. Whether reclining is better than tilting forward, whether clicky keyboards are really healthier than mushy ones, or vice versa, whether trackballs are safer to use than mice, everyone benefits when such questions are taken seriously. We have seen that some complaints were old ones that had been ignored, in part because they affected mainly women, and non-elite women at that. Even the male bosses didn't seem to understand much about comfort in the office, to judge from their own furniture. It took the specter of legal damages to help make them take their own well-being seriously. It is true that this real improvement may not immediately promote satisfaction. It may have the revenge effect of increasing the number of reported problems. As medicine tends to make people feel worse about their health, even when objective measures are improving, better workplace design may focus people's attention on what is still less than optimal. The office can be much safer, though. Specialists believe that by the late 1990s, changes in behavior will complement improved machines and furniture to reduce eye strain, back problems, and cumulative trauma disorders of the modern office. The price of better conditions, however, may involve new complications and higher levels of maintenance. Ergonomists call this the degrees of freedom problem. To respond to changing users and tasks, for example, a chair may have numerous adjustable features, including seat pan and backrest angle, seat pan height, backrest height, tension, and armrest height. The height and angle of keyboard and monitor may also be adjustable. As Marvin J. Danoff and James Bailiat have observed, too many variables may discourage users from trying to take advantage of all the ergonomic features of their equipment, while there are no effective ways to prevent unsatisfactory combinations of adjustments. In combating the repeating effect of office routines, we have found ourselves with a recomplicating effect. Once more, technology usually fails to solve chronic problems in the direct automatic way we have been led to expect or hope. This does not mean that technology fails. Quite the contrary. It means that it requires skill and vigilance. A study in Finland, for example, showed that even with state-of-the-art workstations, employees at video display terminals still had significantly higher musculoskeletal complaints than other office workers, until a physiotherapist explained why and how office equipment should be adjusted. The rate of shoulder pain dropped by 70%. Nobody predicted that automating intellectual work would make it necessary to pay attention so constantly to the body. Nobody thought that just sitting in a chair would become a skill one had to learn. Even taking short breaks from work turns out to require more planning than anyone expected. On their own, workers may return to the office prematurely or plow on until they are too fatigued to continue at all. There seems to be an unexpected benefit of frequent brief interruptions. Productivity improves, though time spent at a given task declines. Even abolishing electronic mail in favor of telephone use and face-to-face meetings seems to have positive effects. The irony of computerization is apparent. The pastel-walled, air-conditioned, computerized office turns out to be a far more complex, possibly dangerous place than even the most hard-bitten Luddites of the 1960s had dared to predict. Just as new devices let men and women complete mental work with less physical exertion than ever before, new complaints and new scientific thinking showed that some of the old inefficiency was actually beneficial and should be reintroduced into the workplace, by corporate decree if necessary. That often deplored metaphor, the information highway, turns out to be surprisingly apt in considering health problems of the computerized office. The massive increase of the power given to the operator, truck driver or white-collar employee, leads to health hazards from rapidly repeated small motions, seat vibration or finger and wrist movement. Focusing occasionally in the distance, maintaining a light touch, maintaining proper posture, and taking frequent breaks can reduce the stress and the likelihood of injury. The similarities can be taken only so far. A software crash or blow-up is not the same as one on the road. Still, the price of health may require the reduction, if not the avoidance, of the intensity that newer technology makes possible. Of course, it helps to have monitors that maintain a tight focus, chairs and work surfaces that adjust, high-quality keyboards and pointing devices, and proper ambient lighting, but many ergonomists emphasize how much can be done without the latest equipment. As usual, revenge effects have an unexpected positive side. Computer-related complaints, as interpreted even by imperfect legal and insurance systems, set natural limits to authority. Physical symptoms have financial consequences that force managers to take stress seriously. Unfortunately, they are not the only obstacles to the profitability of computerizing. It is time to turn to the others.